Chapter 3. Bartimaeus. With dawn, the first people returned to the little town. Hesitant, fearful, groping their way like blind men up the street, they began to inspect the damage wrought to their houses, shops, and gardens. A few night police came with them, ostentatiously flourishing inferno sticks and other weapons, though the threat was long since gone. I was disinclined to move. I spun a concealment around the chunk of chimney where I sat, and removed myself from the human sight. I watched them passing with a baleful eye. My few hours' rest had done me little good. How could it? It had been 2 whole years since I had been allowed to leave this cursed earth. 2 full years since I had last escaped the brainless thronging mass of sweet humanity. I needed more than a quiet kip on a chimney stack to deal with that, I can tell you. I needed to go home. And if I didn't, I was going to die. It is technically possible for a spirit to remain indefinitely on Earth, and many of us at one time or another have endured prolonged visits, usually courtesy of being forcibly trapped inside canopic jars, sandalwood boxes, or other arbitrary spaces chosen by our cruel masters. When goaded into invoking the spell of indefinite confinement, magicians usually compress the spirit into the first object they spy close at hand. I once cheeked a master a little too cleverly during his afternoon tea. Before I knew it, I was imprisoned inside a half-filled pot of strawberry jam, and would have remained there, possibly for all eternity, had not his apprentice opened it by mistake at supper that same evening. Even so, my essence was infested with sticky little seeds for ages after. Dreadful punishment, though this is, it at least has the advantage of being safe and quiet. You aren't called upon to do anything, so your increasingly weakened essence is not immediately at risk. The main threat comes from the remorseless tedium, which can lead to insanity in the spirit in question. The Afrit Honorius was a case in point. He went mad after 100 years' confinement in a skeleton. A rather poor show. I like to think with my engaging personality I could keep myself entertained a little longer than that. My current predicament was in stark contrast. Not for me the luxury of being hidden away in a cosy lamp or amulet. No, day in, day out, I was a jinni on the street, ducking, diving, taking risks, exposing myself to danger. And each day it became a little more difficult to survive. For I was no longer the carefree Bartimaeus of old. My essence was raddled with earth's corruption, my mind was bleary with the pain. I was slower, weaker, distracted from my tasks. I found it hard to change form. In battle my attacks were sputtering and weak. My detonations had the explosive power of lemonade. My convulsions trembled like jelly in a breeze. All my strength had gone. Where once, in the previous night's scrap, I would have sent that public convenience right back at the Sheepig, adding a phone box and a bus stop for good measure, now I could do nothing to resist. I was vulnerable as a kitten. A few small buildings in the face I could stand, but already I was practically at the mercy of second-rate fops such as Ascobol, a fool with no great history to speak of. And if I met a foe with even a grain of power, my luck would surely end. It is a curious fact that despite our fury at being summoned into this world, spirits such as I derive a good deal of retrospective satisfaction from our exploits. At the time, of course, we do our darndest to avoid them, but afterward we often display a certain weary pride in the cleverest, bravest, or most jammy events on our resume. Philosophers might speculate this is because we are essentially defined by our experiences in this world, since in the other place we are not so easily individualized. Thus those with long and glittering careers, e.g. me, tend to look down on those, e.g. Ascobol, whose names have been unearthed more recently and haven't amassed so many fine achievements. In Ascobol's case I also disliked him for his silly falsetto voice, which ill becomes an 8-foot cyclops. A weak jinni is a bad slave, bad twice over, since he is both ineffective and a laughing-stock. It does a magician no favours to maintain one in the world. This is the reason why they usually allow us back to the other place on a temporary basis, to repair our essence and renew our strength. No master in his right mind would permit a jinni to deteriorate as far as I had done. No master in his right mind. Well, that, of course, was the problem. I was interrupted in my gloomy cogitation by a stirring in mid-air. The girl looked up. Above the road appeared the faintest shimmering, a delicate tingling of pretty pink and yellow lights. It was invisible on the first plane, and thus went unnoticed by the people trudging up the street, but if any children had seen it, they'd probably have guessed it to be fairy dust, which shows how wrong you can be. With an abrupt scratching noise, the lights froze, and were drawn back from the middle like two curtains. Between them appeared the grinning face of a bald baby with bad acne. Its evil little eyes were red and sore, indicating an owner who kept long hours and bad habits. For a few moments they peered myopically to and fro. The baby swore under its breath and rubbed its eyes with dirty little fists. All at once it noticed my concealment and let out a dreadful oath. Probably Germanic in origin. It involved nailing someone's entrails to an oak tree. I regarded it with cool impassivity.
"Oi, Bart!" the baby cried. "That you in there? Stir yourself! You're wanted!"
I spoke casually. "By whom?"
"You know full well. And boy, are you in trouble! I reckon it's the shrivelling fire for sure this time."
"Is that so?" The girl remained firmly seated on the broken chimney and crossed her slender arms. "Well, if Mandrake wants me, he can come and get me himself." The baby grinned nastily.
"Good. I was hoping you'd say that. No problem, Barty. I'll pass that on. Can't wait to see what he'll do."
The imp's malicious glee irritated me. We were, after all, slaves together. We had both suffered long at Mandrake's hands. A bit of empathy would not, I think, have been out of place. But the imp's long confinement had rather soured its world view, which has happened to far better spirits than it over the years. If I'd had a little more energy, I'd have leapt up and swallowed it there and then. I contented myself with snapping off a chimney-pot and throwing it with unerring aim. It struck the baby's bald, fat head with a satisfactory ringing sound. "As I thought," I said. "Hollow." The unlovely grin converted into a scowl.
"You cad! Just you wait. We'll see who's laughing when I watch you burn."
Propelled by a gust of ripe language, it popped back behind its curtains of glimmering lights and drew them smartly together. Twinkling softly, the lights dissipated on the breeze. The imp was gone. The girl pushed a strand of hair behind one ear, refolded her arms grimly, and settled back to wait. Now there would be consequences, which was exactly what I needed. It was time for a proper confrontation. To begin with, years before, my master and I had got along well enough. I don't mean amicably or anything ridiculous like that, but our mutual irritation was founded on something approximating respect. During a series of early incidents, from the Lovelace conspiracy to the Golem affair, I'd been forced to acknowledge Mandrake's verve and daring, his energy, and even, faintly, the glimmerings of his conscience. It wasn't much, admittedly, but it made his prissiness, stubbornness, pride, and ambition a little less hard to stomach. In return, I obviously had no shortage of wonderful traits for him to admire, and anyway, he could barely get up in the morning without needing me to save his sorry skin. We coexisted in a wary state of toleration. For a year or so, after the defeat of the Golem and Mandrake's promotion to head of internal affairs, he didn't push me around too much. He summoned me from time to time to help out with minor incidents, which I haven't got time to go into here, but generally speaking he left me pretty much alone. If memory serves, these included the case of the Afrit, the envelope, and the ambassador's wife, the affair of the curiously heavy trunk, and the messy episode of the anarchist and the oyster. Mandrake nearly lost his life in all of those. As I say, none of them was of much interest. On the odd occasion that he did call me, we both knew where he stood. We had an agreement of sorts. I knew his birth name, and he knew I knew it. Though he threatened me with dire consequences if I told anyone, In practice, he treated me with careful detachment in all our dealings. I kept his name to myself, and he kept me away from the most dangerous tasks, which basically boiled down to the fighting in America. Dozens of Jin were dying there. The reverberations of the losses rang harshly through the other place, and I was happy to have no part in it. To those of us abreast with human history, the cause of the latest war was drearily familiar. For years the Americans had refused to pay the taxes demanded of them by London. The British swiftly fell back on the oldest argument of all, and sent over an army to beat the colonists up. After initial easy victories, stagnation set in. The rebels retreated into thick woods, sending Jin out to ambush the advancing troops. Several prominent British magicians were killed. The 6th and 7th fleets were summoned from the China Seas to bolster the campaign, but still the fighting dribbled on. Months went by. The Empire's strength was frittered away in the American wastes, and the repercussions resounded around the globe. Time passed. Mandrake worked at his job with his usual zeal. An opportunity for promotion came, and he accepted it. He was now Information Minister, one of the great ones of the Empire. His chance came, thanks to the war. The rebel guerrillas were causing the British Army problems. After a year of attritional fighting, the Foreign Minister, a certain Mr. Fry, visited the colonists secretly with a view to arranging a truce. 8 magicians watched him as he travelled. A host of haulers guarded his every step. The minister was invulnerable, or so they thought. On his first night in Philadelphia, he was treacherously slain by an imp concealed in his evening pie. Amid general outrage, the Prime Minister reshuffled his ministers, and Mandrake joined the ruling council. Officially, his duties were to do with propaganda, devising clever ways of selling the war to the British people. Unofficially, at the Prime Minister's behest, he continued much of his internal affairs police work, operating an unsavoury network of surveillance djinn and human spies, which reported directly to him. His workload, which had always been severe, now became crippling. There followed a dismal sea change in my master's personality. Never exactly famous for his light-hearted banter, he became positively abrupt and antisocial, even less willing than before to shoot the breeze with a debonair djinni. But by cruel paradox, he also began to summon me more and more frequently, and for less and less reason. Why did he do so? Mainly, no doubt, because he wished to minimize the chances of my being summoned by another magician. His old fear, now fueled by chronic fatigue and paranoia, was that I would divulge his birth name to an enemy, rendering him vulnerable to attack. Well, fair enough. That was always possible. I might have done it. Can't say for sure. But he'd managed without me in the past, and nothing had happened to him. So I thought something else was going on, too. Mandrake masked his emotions well enough, but his whole life was work, remorseless and never-ending. Moreover, he was now surrounded by a gang of vicious, hot-eyed maniacs, the other ministers, most of whom wished him harm. His only close associate, for a time, was the hack playwright Quentin Makepeace, as self-serving as all the rest. To survive in this friendless world, Mandrake cloaked his better qualities under layers of smarm and swank. All his old life, the years with the Underwoods, his vulnerable existence as the boy Nathaniel, the ideals he'd once espoused, was buried away deep down. Every link with his childhood was severed, except for me. I don't think he could bring himself to break this last connection. I proposed this theory in my usual gentle way, but Mandrake was unwilling to listen to my taunts. He was a worried man. I'm stretching the term a bit here, I know. By now, in his mid to late teens, he might just about have passed for a man, when seen from behind, at a distance, on a very dark night. The American campaigns were vastly expensive. The British supply lines overstretched. With the magician's attention diverted, other parts of the Empire had become troublesome. Foreign spies infested London like maggots in an apple. The commoners were volatile. To counter all this, Mandrake worked like a slave. Well, not literally like a slave. That was my job. And a pretty thankless one it was, too. Back at Internal Affairs, some of the assignments had been almost worthy of my talents. I'd intercepted enemy messages and deciphered them, given out false reports, trailed enemy spirits, duffed a few of them up, etc. It was simple, satisfying work. I got a craftsman's pleasure from it. In addition, I helped Mandrake and the police in the search for two fugitives from the Golem affair. The first of these was a certain mysterious mercenary. Distinguishing features, big beard, grim expression, swanky black clothes, general invulnerability to infernos, detonations, pretty much everything else. He'd last been seen far away in Prague, and predictably enough we never got a whiff of him. The second was an even more nebulous character, whom no one had even set eyes on. He apparently went by the name of Hopkins, and claimed to be a scholar. He was generally suspected of masterminding the Golem plot, and I'd heard he'd been involved with the Resistance, too. But he might as well have been a ghost or shadow, for all the substance we could pin down. We found a spidery signature in an admissions book at an old library that might have been his. That was all. The trail, such as it was, went cold. Then Mandrake became Information Minister, and I was soon engaged in more depressing work, viz. Pasting up adverts on 1,000 billboards across London, distributing pamphlets to 25,000 homes across ditto, corralling selected animals for public holiday entertainments. Following the Roman tradition, the magician sought to keep the people docile with regular holidays, in which free shows were put on in all the major parks. Lots of exotic beasts from across the empire were displayed, as were minor imps and sprites allegedly caught during the war. Human prisoners were paraded along the streets, or enclosed in special glass viewing globes in the St. James's Park pavilions for the populace to jeer at. Supervising food, drink, and hygiene for same, flying back and forth across the capital for hours on end, trailing pro-war banners. Now, call me picky, but I'd argue that when you think of a 5,000-year-old jinni, the scourge of civilizations and confidant of kings, certain things come to mind. Swashbuckling espionage, perhaps, or valiant battles, thrilling escapes, and general multipurpose excitement. What you don't readily think of is that same noble jinni being forced to prepare giant vats of chili con carne for festival days, or struggling on street corners with bill posters and pots of glue, especially without being allowed to return home. Soon my periods of respite in the other place became so fleeting I practically got whiplash travelling there and back. Then one day Mandrake ceased dismissing me altogether, and that was it. I was trapped on Earth. Over the next 2 years I grew steadily weaker, and just when I was hitting rock bottom, scarcely able to lift a poster brush, the wretched boy began sending me out on more dangerous missions again, fighting bands of enemy djinn that Britain's many enemies were using to stir up trouble. In the past, I'd have had a quiet word with Mandrake, expressing my disapproval with succinct directness. But my privileged access to him was no more. He'd taken to summoning me along with a host of other slaves, giving orders en masse and sending us off like a pack of dogs. Such multiple summoning is a difficult business, requiring great mental strength on the part of the magician, but Mandrake did it daily without apparent effort, talking quietly with his assistant, or even flicking through a newspaper while we stood and sweated in our circles. I did my best to get to him. Instead of using a monstrous guise like my fellow slaves, Ascobol's Cyclops and Cormacodron's boar-headed behemoth were typical, I took to wearing the semblance of Kitty Jones, the Resistance girl Mandrake had persecuted years before. Her assumed death still weighed on his conscience. I knew this because he always reacted to my echo of her face with a reddening of his own. He'd get all angry and sheepish, assertive and embarrassed at the same time. Didn't make him treat me any better, mind. Well, I'd had about as much as I could stand from Mandrake. It was time to have it out with him. By refusing to go back with the imp, I obliged the magician to recall me officially, which would doubtless hurt, but was at least likely to mean he gave me the benefit of his attention for 5 minutes. The imp had been gone for hours. In the past I'd have got a swift response from my master, but the delay was typical of his new distractedness. I smoothed back Kitty Jones's long dark hair and cast my eye around the little rural town. Several commoners had gathered around the ruined post office and were engaged in passionate debate. They resisted the efforts of a lone policeman to make them return to their homes. No doubt about it, the people were growing restless. Which turned my thoughts to Kitty once again. Despite appearances to the contrary, she hadn't died in battle with the golem 3 years before. Instead, after acting with unusual selflessness and bravery to save Mandrake's worthless hide, she'd slipped quietly away. Our encounter had been brief but stimulating. Her passionate opposition to injustice reminded me of someone else I'd known a long time ago. Part of me hoped Kitty had bought a one-way ticket to somewhere safe and distant and had set up a cafe on a beach or something out of harm's way. But deep down I knew she was still close by, working against the magicians. That knowledge rather pleased me, though she'd had no love for gin. Whatever she was doing, I hoped she was keeping out of trouble.